Coming up on Tech News Today, Apple fires people. There's lots of fallout from the Hurricane Sandy affecting the internet. And do we need big device announcements? Maybe not. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, October 30th, 2012. Tech News Today is brought to you by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why we love our cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 a month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by American Express Bank FSB, offering a high-yield savings account, the perfect complement to help you reach your savings goals. To learn more and open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/online savings, member FDIC. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your iPhone, iPad, MacBook, or Android smartphones. Find out what your gadget is worth and get cash to upgrade to the latest iPhone at gazelle.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zakhtar.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world, starting each time with the top 10 stories of the day in the news fuse. Explosion. Apple exploded some things yesterday afternoon, announcing changes to increase collaboration across hardware, software, and services.
Oh, that doesn't sound personal.
It's a euphemism for we fired two people. Those changes involved letting go John Browett immediately, head of Apple Retail, and announcing that Scott Forstall, head of the iOS team, will leave the company within a year. He'll remain on as an advisor to Tim Cook. Johnny Ive will take over all design, both hardware and software. Eddie Q takes over Siri and Maps. Craig Federighi gets iOS. And Bob Mansfield will not leave Apple. He will now head a new technology group dealing with wireless and semiconductor hardware.
Who needs a big event anyway?
Nobody.
Google announced the Nexus 4 smartphone, not Google anyway, which is a lovelier version of LG's Optimus G. The Nexus 7, a bigger storage version of the Nexus 7 that was announced back in June. And the Nexus 10, a Samsung-made 10-inch display that has a 2560 by 1600 pixel resolution, making for 300 pixels per inch, which, just for the record, is better than an iPad Retina display. And priced competitively, the 16 gigabyte version costs $399. The 32 gigabyte version costs $499. That's in the hundreds. No LTE, though.
And now on weather, me. Servers for BuzzFeed, the Huffington Post, and Gawker were knocked offline by Hurricane Sandy. Some of the sites have taken to Tumblr and Twitter to keep up their online presence. Meanwhile, Google has added a new layer to its crisis maps that shows what areas are hit with power outages. That's also available on mobile. Good on you, Google.
Squarespace sent out an email saying their servers were going to go down because of flooding, but right now my Squarespace site is still up.
Oh, yeah, I haven't
checked
that.
Maybe they figured it out. Oats. John Poole of Primate Labs has posted about benchmarks for the new fourth generation iPad that appeared Sunday night on the Geekbench browser. If the benchmark is accurate, the new iPad runs a 1.4 gigahertz processor with a gig of RAM. Performance is about 10% faster than the iPhone 5 and around double that of the third generation iPad.
AMD loves ARM.
Really?
I was about to say RAM, but that's a different
word. They probably love RAM,
altogether. Too. No, they love ARM. At least enough to license ARM for future Opteron server chips. They'll be in the next generation of server products that will begin to appear in 2014. Details are still a little thin, but we do know AMD is taking out a full-fledged ARM license. And on Monday, talked up future system-on-a-chip developments, meaning that AMD plans to develop and release Opteron-branded server parts that mix ARM's technology with its own architecture at the die level.
Can't hug a child with AMD's ARM.
Speaking of ARM processors, the rumor mill says that NVIDIA's Tegra 4 processor will be shown off at CES in January 2013, with more partners announced in February's Mobile World Congress. The Tegra 4 is based on the ARM Cortex A15 architecture and is aimed at tablets and is supposed to offer 10 times the performance of Tegra 2 dual-core chips and twice that of Tegra 3.
Venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz has become a bit of a star maker in Silicon Valley, so a lot of attention is being paid to the fact that they're in on the $15.5 million backing of a company called ItzOn. ItzOn plans to create software that would give mobile carriers more flexibility in how they charge customers for data.
The UK's first 4G service is up and running in 11 cities today with the launch of EE's, which is Everything Everywhere's, LTE network. The company says it plans to expand coverage by 2,000 square miles every month and claims that 74% of businesses plan to adopt 4G within the next year. In fact, Everything Everywhere says it intends to add 5 more cities to its network before Christmas and to cover 98% of the population by the end of 2014. That means adding coverage for 2 million people each month.
The Register reports analyst outfit TrendForce has pegged Lenovo as the top Chinese smartphone company just 6 months after launching its first smartphone. Lenovo has 14.7% of the market, according to TrendForce, leaping past ZTE and Huawei. Korean company Samsung is just ahead of Lenovo in China with 15.5% of the market.
Oh, I love TrendForce. I have all the comic books. Folks in the UK can now get their hands on the Nook Simple Touch Glow Light for £109. The Simple Touch is also available now for £79. If e-readers aren't your thing, the Nook HD and Nook HD Plus are up for pre-order over at the newly launched uk.nook.com and will be available next month.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Ring Central. When we built the studio here in Petaluma, California, we wanted to do as much stuff in the cloud as possible. We wanted to spend money on making the studio work well and look good and not spend a bunch of money on a big PBX system in the basement for phones. I mean, people have cell phones anyway. But we've needed some desk phones. That's why when Russell said, you know what, try out Ring Central, it was a no-brainer. Ring Central has zero startup costs, none of that expensive, complicated PBX hardware, and allows you to customize all of your call handling. Producers can get voicemail in their email, get our fax messages right on our smartphones. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 a month per user. And you can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial. If you're like, okay, maybe RingCentral works for you fancy studio people, but it'll work for me. Try it out. 30 days risk-free. They have a special offer for our listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number. It's designated for our listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. There's one guy that wasn't listening, so here you go. 800-543-9980. Or you can also go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of Tech News Today. Joining us now to discuss the technology world, Rafe Needleman of Evernote, a former co-worker of mine at CNET. I just combined them together. But you're now an evangelist for Evernote, which you always kind of were, I have to say. So
yeah,
this was beautiful for you.
This was an inevitable move, I guess.
An Evernotable move.
People got drunk with the every time Rafe mentions Evernote drinking game. So here I am. Now you guys are going to be really soused.
Well, it's good to have you on the show, man. Thanks for joining us again. Especially, we got some juicy stuff to dig into. Let's start with Apple shaking up their executive team. Scott Forstall on the outs. Lots of reports about why. The Wall Street Journal saying that the fact that he refused to sign the letter apologizing for Maps was a key reason. Forstall also reportedly not cooperative with, he didn't play well with others, told people there's no decider anymore now that Steve Jobs is gone, sent an email to the mobile team accusing them of not working on big ideas anymore, and GigaOm even saying that this was sort of a last minute thing. Engineers at Apple were taken by surprise when this email went out. Tim Cook sent an email internally as well as posting the press release online. John Browett getting summarily fired. Forstall's sticking around for a year. John Browett is out. They're looking for a replacement for him. That was not as much of a surprise. That's been brewing for a long time. A lot of people have been critical of what he's been doing with Apple retail, especially employees who are upset about hours being cut. Changes have been made and then rolled back. I think there's been some controversy there. So now we see Tim Cook really putting his stamp on this company. And saying, well, these are the people I trust. These are the people I want in charge. And a lot of people are very excited. Johnny Ive, now head of human interface. So everything Johnny Ive is going to have Johnny Ive's touch on it. And the death of skeuomorphism has been declared. That's when you make things that kind of look like real life things, and the stitching and moving tape reels and stuff like that. Johnny Ive apparently doesn't like that stuff. That stuff might be going away. Rafe, what do you make of all of these things? Do you think it's surprising that Forstall got shoved out?
Well, if he was as if people were as uncomfortable working around him as reported, then I'm not surprised. you know, under the Jobs regime, being uncomfortable with your boss was kind of the way things worked. But I guess Tim's got a kind of different way of doing things. The other thing, of course, is, you know, somebody's head in this new Apple, somebody's head had to roll for Maps. And in the past, you know, with Siri and with AntennaGate, that went all the way up to Jobs. And Jobs had this amazing gift of being able to say, we goofed up, but we really didn't, and move on. And that's a very rare thing to be able to do for a company, to take that responsibility, to get people to move on. And I guess at the new Apple, the Cook Apple, it's different. It's more like a real company where somebody, where something goes bad, somebody's head is on the block.
I'm pretty sure somebody got fired. The hardware
engineering guy. It was a lower level, I think, Masterson, for AntennaGate. Yeah.
After that happened, they lost somebody was employed for hardware. But the Forrestal move, I was kind of surprised with. I mean, we've read the reports where he's divisive and people don't like him, and he politics his way up to the top, and apparently he was Steve Jobs' guy.
He worked with Steve Jobs at Next.
Right, yeah. So he's been with him for a long time.
Yeah, and he had also hoped to be a successor at some point. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe after Tim Cook, it might be Scott Forstall's time, and that doesn't necessarily go over well when you're gunning for the top spot. Now, making that known.
Forstall's a little older than Steve Jobs was, but in some ways, this feels a bit like Steve Jobs leaving Apple at the end of the 80s when he was sort of forced out and people said, he's unpleasant to work with. Is this what Scott Forstall needed? Is he going to wander in the wilderness like Steve Jobs and come back stronger and better?
That's a good question. I do think that something like he refused to sign the apology for Maps is probably just a nail in the coffin that was going to happen anyway. I mean, if there was no apology to write in the first place, then you wouldn't have that problem.
So that sounds to me like a little bit of an invented thing. I mean, because the apology came out, it was signed from the guy, from Tim, right? Tim said, we're sorry. Now, if Scott had signed that, would it have had the same impact?
It would have looked like they had thrown Forstall at his sword to me. The fact that Tim Cook signed it felt like the right thing of like, we're not going to point fingers. I'm the CEO.
I speak for the company.
Yeah. I do think, though, that there is definitely a feeling in Apple that they're glad Scott Forstall is on his way out. There was a senior Apple employee quoted on All Things D saying, this was better than the Giants winning the World Series. People are really excited. Doesn't mean that it's good for Apple that he's gone necessarily. We can talk about that separately, but obviously not somebody that is going to be missed by a lot of people in the company.
Well, they're not replacing him directly. His duties are split up between a bunch of different people. There's one guy in charge of iOS and OS X. I mean, the two operating systems.
Yeah, Craig Federighi is taking over iOS. He already was in charge of OS X. Mm-hmm. And then Eddie Q is taking over Siri and Maps. Q's kind of the fixer.
Yeah,
he's the guy who
sounds like it. Yeah,
yeah.
Here's Siri and Maps. That's like the hardest job at Apple. That's like, well, I don't make political things, but that sounds like a tough country to fix.
I think he fixed MobileMe into iCloud. That's his big legacy at this point. So if he can make, you know, if he can fix Siri and Maps, that'd be very impressive. But OS X and iOS are kind of merging anyway, so it seems like we might get some really interesting things on iOS, hopefully, because a lot of the things that people are saying about Forstall is that iOS has been kind of stagnant for the past couple of years. Android's been killing it when it comes to new features. And we have, we have paper shredders in our passbooks and things. That's snazzy, but, like, is that really a function that is innovative at this point? And with Johnny Ive on the human interface side, very curious about what the operating system is going to look like from here on in.
The other thing that I wanted to note in the GigaOm story about this, Om Malik says that he's heard a lot of people complaining that Apple now has a schedule-driven culture, that one of the reasons that Siri was put out in beta, one of the reasons that Maps was shoved out the door with known bugs, was that they've gone from the culture under Steve Jobs of when it's ready, we ship it, to this is the date we need to hit it. Now, I didn't get the sense that this was necessarily a Scott Forstall thing entirely, that it's just more of a general thing at Apple these days.
Well, if they moved to a schedule-based thing and Forstall basically made it very difficult to work with, maybe Apple figures things will go much faster without him. We've got four
guys
up here.
Is that a good thing? I mean, the thing about Apple that was nice was you knew it was going to work when you got it.
Well, I think it was.
Yeah, no, Apple has had its fair share of flubs. I mean, we talked about me and Siri, the antennas. I mean, you know, even the non-schedule-driven culture that we're talking about doesn't always produce, you know, gems. But And in this particular case with Maps, I mean, I think it will be good for Apple to ship things when Apple thinks it's ready, even if they're wrong. I mean, that would make probably Maps better. But Maps was driven by a schedule, not just Apple's own internal schedule. The Google contract was running out, and the cooperation between Google and Apple was a sticking point for both companies. They are beginning to separate, and that can't happen fast enough for either of them, I don't think. I think there's more to it than just Forrestal wants to put things on us. We will ship this by such and such date. It's much more complex.
Is there any company you guys think that would want to pick up Forrestal at this point? Well, with all the rumors about him, I mean, Google, I don't know. Do they want to pick him up just for this huge hire?
I think Samsung would like to pick him up.
Oh, dear gosh.
In fact, one of the articles I read speculated that the reason he's being kept on for a year as an advisor to Tim Cook is partly to keep him from going to some place like that.
Yeah, that whole advisor thing is like,
oh yeah.
Technically, he's still there, but he's pretty much been people who have been working for him are now working for other people. It doesn't really sound like he's going to have much of a role at Apple at all.
They put jobs in Siberia, same kind of thing. It's like, we'll just put you in this one building where nobody else is, and you won't even have a phone to talk to Tim.
Yeah. Well, I do see a lot of parallels to what happened to Jobs and what's happened to Forrestal. So I'll be very curious to see where he ends up and what he does.
And, you know, even if you just take away, let's say Scott Forrestal wasn't a jerk and nobody had anything bad to say about him, and he was a really nice guy and did a lot of good things and tried to keep to a schedule. It does seem like iOS could use some new life.
Yeah.
A little bit of a new direction. I mean, that makes sense to me. And if Tim Cook is a cutthroat boss, and signs lead me to believe that he is, he probably saw this coming a while ago.
Well, Scott Forrestal, I hope that you make it safely out of your isolation chamber within a year, and we look forward to seeing what you do next. Meanwhile, yesterday we were talking about the launch of the Google products in the middle of the show. Google was supposed to have a 7 a.m. announcement yesterday, obviously with the hurricane and the announcement being scheduled in an evacuation zone. They couldn't have that, but they went ahead and announced the products anyway.
Yeah, and the press was all over this. Obviously, NDAs were lifted, so all the articles hit pretty much the same time, even hands-on videos and photos. An article over at Electric Pig just asked the question, what's the real benefit of a big keynote launch anyway? It used to be that Apple was like the only company that had these surprise events and people would show up. Every other company would just have these small press releases, and Electric Pig calls these events the press release glammed up and stretched out over the course of at least an hour. So yesterday we had these press releases from Google and all these hands-on things, and then we also had the 70-minute or 75-minute Microsoft presentation for Windows Phone 8. Considering how much press Google Nexus on the Nexus line got already without needing this little event, and what happened with Windows Phone 8, do we even need, or is there a benefit to press events at this point?
Sure, as long as they're announcing a bunch of cool stuff. I mean, wasn't that the problem with the Windows Phone 8 announcement? Was that there was not a whole lot of substance in 75 minutes?
We got a very long, rambling, and incoherent criticism that had one good point in it in our email, which is there was a lot of stuff in the Windows Phone 8 announcement that the general populace probably didn't know because the previous announcement was a developers conference. And I think that's where Microsoft's head was, is this is our announcement of Windows Phone 8, so we're going to tell you a lot of things that we may have already talked about, but we've talked about them in developer situations, not to the public. But the fact of the matter is, I think what Google showed here is very interesting. We all saw the headlines. We got excited about the products. We talked about the products. We read about the products without having to have some live-streamed event. Rafe, do you think that Google misses out? Do you think that we need to have these Apple-like events? We didn't used to. It was Apple that sort of made that popular.
Well, you know, a big press event or a big product announcement has two audiences, right? There's the press who absorbs the information, and there's the public who wants to read the information. Now, the thing is, with most events, for most of the public, I would estimate 99.9% of it, they take in the information that is released at a new product launch or a press announcement in probably about 30 seconds, maybe 2 or 3 minutes. They read the stories, they watch the video, they say, oh, a new product X. How cool. And that's it. So the 30-minute long or the 1 hour or the 2 hour long press announcement is for the benefit of the press to hopefully get them excited and write deeper stories. But all those stories end up being collapsed into a 2-minute attention span of end users anyway. So Google's videos for the Nexus, you know, three-way launch that they did, which was, you know, that video that they did of here's how the new Android Nexus products work is unbelievably compelling. I mean, I'm an Apple fanboy these days, and I was looking at those Google products saying, wow, I want those. They really did a good job of encapsulating what the product is about and creating excitement without requiring people to have these gigantic events. So I think the answer to the question is, if you're Apple, maybe. But for the most part, the audience that you're trying to reach, the buyers, they absorb this thing so fast, you don't need really to stretch it out. And I appreciate it.
Yeah. I was just going to say, and it seemed like a lot of people had already been briefed, had seen these devices, had their hands on them. There was really no reason to get them together in a room for that. And they were kind of already excited about them.
I mean, you need to go to give the media or whoever, if there's limited number of products available or there's no stores, like not, it's just the case with everybody but Apple, you need to give the media a place to put their hands on, do the first looks and all that kind of stuff. So you want a show-off event, but to stretch out a two-page long press release over the course of 2 hours with a musical number and all that kind of thing, I don't know. I'm over it. I don't know about you guys.
I want Wolf Boy from the Samsung CES announcement.
You want him back?
Years back. Yeah.
I'm just thinking like...
More Wolf Boy. Less substance.
We saw that video of the Nexus devices, and the weird thing is during these press events, they're like, so, we have a video for you. We're going to show it to you now because it can't be made available any which other way, so it will be later. So we have to sit here and watch you show it on a screen and then switch.
And then hear your applause.
Yeah, great. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
You know, the weird thing is when I was covering these things for the press and trying to write live, if I wanted to go hang out with my buddies and kind of soak in the ambiance and it was a big Microsoft, Google, or Apple event, I'd get a ticket and I'd go to the event and I'd hang out with the audience and I'd try to cover it. But if my job was to really cover what was happening at the event in real time with as much precision and accuracy as possible, I would try to get a stream and not do it from the press hall because that was such a zoo. So I try to sit at my desk, headphones on, and work from the live stream there. It's more efficient. So the whole idea of going to these big events is it's pure theater.
Yeah, I agree. And hopefully this will be taken seriously by a lot of companies. And not saying that we shouldn't have any events for anything anymore, but we don't need to have we're starting to get an event for everything.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it feels like.
A little ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the hurricane. Obviously, you can't avoid it. Mm-hmm. It passed.
Superstorm.
It's now a superstorm. It's come to ground. And we're dealing with the fallout with it now.
I don't know about all the rest of you, but I never actually turned on my TV last night when I was following the storm. I mean, I'm obviously safely on the West Coast and really far removed from it, but I have a lot of friends and a little bit of family that lives over there. And social media, it really shines in situations like this because not only do people like me get the information in real time, but you're starting to see people helping other people and trying to spread the word about this and that. But not without its issues. As Ayaz mentioned in the news fuse, the storm did affect the servers of some big news orgs, Gawker Media, The Huffington Post, BuzzFeed, all were down. BuzzFeed was actually has a pretty big Tumblr presence anyway. They were one of the first news orgs to get on Tumblr a couple years ago. Has a big following there, but they figured, all right, well, our main servers are down. We've already got a presence over on Tumblr. So we can just start Tumblr blogs, at least for the interim, that deal with the politics section of BuzzFeed, the music section of BuzzFeed. Just, you know, it's pretty smart and quick thinking on their part. As last I checked, that was still up and going. HuffPo and Gawker both using Twitter to keep readers informed, which is not even really something that they have to announce. Here's what you do now, because a lot of people already follow organizations on Twitter
right.
in order to get the news that they need. Of course, a lot of the news was storm related, but that just kind of helps overall. But then, and let me know what you guys think about this too, is you're watching all of this stuff come in, and I can't help but feel that there's a little bit of that breathless excitement that happens in situations like this. And there's opportunistic type stuff that happens where people really want to feel like, you know, I'm the first to tell everybody about this terrible tragedy that's happening. And you kind of start feeling weird about it. And then you start seeing these pictures that get retweeted 200 times. And it's like, oh, the shark in somebody's front yard was a fake. That didn't actually happen. And actually, the New York Stock Exchange floor isn't actually flooding. That's just something someone started to freak everybody out. And Con Edison isn't actually shutting power down in the entire city. And there aren't actually Con Ed workers trying to escape water overflow in a basement somewhere. And at the same time, like I said, I'm not watching TV because they're the last to know. I mean, they're looking at their phones like the rest of us.
I was watching TV, though, and, and looking at Twitter at the same time. And I have to say, I was getting better information on television last night. And I was watching first the Weather Channel, which I thought did a spectacular job, although they passed along the flooding in the Wall Street or in the New York Stock Exchange as unconfirmed, but they did pass it along. Meanwhile, somebody on Twitter pointed to me to Channel 325 on DirecTV, which was taking the local feeds from New York and Hartford and Philadelphia and kind of cycling through them so that you could get the coverage on the ground. They were doing a great job. WABC was on top of it. I felt like that's how I knew exactly what was going on. They were actually at the hospital that was that had the generator failure. They were talking to people, and they were showing people at NYU being evacuated. They had video of the explosion of the transformer, and they were talking to Con Edison. I felt like that was the best information I was getting because I was less likely to get misinformation, and I was getting direct source information. I think live video, whether it's broadcast TV or streamed, frankly, it doesn't really matter to me, is still the best for this kind of coverage. Because Yeah, go ahead, Rafe.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, this is what journalists do. This is their, this is perfect for them. You know, sending the guy out in the yellow slicker to the edge of, you know, the seawall where the waves are coming over him, you know, you think it's cheesy, but that's actually a service to say, look, we're here in lower Manhattan, and the waves are coming over onto the street. For, that's incredibly – that is what TV news people are trained to do, report, go to the place where the news is happening, report on it accurately, and show you what's happening. That's something that a citizen journalist, even if they want to do, might not be able to get past the police lines. So there's a real value to that. I agree with you. I think that in this type of a disaster situation, the professional, paid, big buck, mainstream media actually is in their element, or all of them at the same time in this particular case.
And I think Twitter provided a great second screen. Like that, I was definitely getting information on Twitter that and perspectives that I wouldn't get otherwise, but it was complimentary for
and
me.
And a lot of it was knee-jerk, that's not always necessarily right. So a real combination between citizen journalism and then actual journalists who do this for a living, trying to say, okay, let's separate the fact from fiction and try not to get too sensational about everything.
Yeah, there's always an element of that element of the fakes. Like, I mean, this happens with every like tragedy that the people will now, you'll see spyware probably like, oh, look at these videos of things that have happened. You'll probably see all kinds of these fake photos as well. It's just this weird exploitative thing that happens around these events that just, it makes it harder to find information, but to find out where you can get it, like television and journalists, instead of going, well, I don't know if that thing, I have to check Snopes for everything to see if everything's real or not.
There's levels of quality in journalists, believe me. I did not think that some of the national broadcast networks did a very good job at all. They just seemed to not really know what they were doing. So you have to pick your sources in all of these cases. Just like there's citizen journalists who pass along crappy, breathless stuff, and then there's citizen journalists who actually provide really, really good, valid, valuable stuff. So,
can I say one more thing? Man, those East Coasters just—they get so much warning before their natural disasters. I mean, out here in earthquake country, it's over before it starts, and you're devastated. So, I mean, I'm really, Rafe,
you're going to complain today.
What's that?
You're going to complain today.
I'm going to complain about, can we have warnings for earthquakes, please? I would love a couple of days to prepare.
For goodness sake.
We do. It's those days where it's sort of humid and unseasonably hot, and we all say, seems like earthquake weather today.
And then there's always an earthquake on that. No, there's
100% of the time.
100%.
If you're smart.
Let's take a break and thank our other sponsor for today's show, American Express Bank, FSB, member FDIC. If you're saving for a car, you're saving for a home down payment, just maybe saving for an emergency fund, which is smart. You want to have the best way to save possible. Whatever your goals for savings are, American Express Bank is a good place to put your money. And American Express Personal Savings High Yield Savings Account gives you a competitive variable interest rate to help you reach your savings goals without making you change your bank. If you're like, well, I love my bank, I don't want to change my bank. You don't have to. You can link this savings account to your existing bank account without having to switch banks. You can transfer money back and forth depending on your needs. Check your balance by phone or web 24/7. There's no minimums and get this, no fees. And there's great phone support whenever you want to talk to someone. This account is a great complement to your existing financial tools and is FDIC insured. offered by American Express Bank, FSB. So take control of your finances today while you're at personalsavings.com/online savings to find out more. Why not open an account? There's no minimums, no fees, and no need to switch banks. All you need to do to get started is go to personalsavings.com/online savings and open a high-yield savings account offered by American Express Bank, FSB. That's the high-yield savings account at personalsavings.com/online savings, member FDIC. And we thank American Express Bank, FSB, for their support of Tech News Today. We have, we talked in the News Fuse, actually, about Andreessen Horowitz backing this company. It's what? What's
it? It's on.
It's on. Oh, it's on. It is.
One word.
Yeah.
Or it's Sun. I don't think it's.
It's Intercapped though with an O. CEO Greg Raleigh quoted in one of the stories I read saying most people don't use the majority of the service they purchase. That's what It's On wants to fix. They want to make it so that you only pay for the data you use. Mark Andreessen, famous founder of Netscape and part of Andreessen Horowitz, said, today, a large number of customers who don't use much data are subsidizing a small number of people who use a ton of data. And they talked a lot in these stories about carriers' capital expenditures ballooning to more than $20 billion a year, smartphone use rising, the cost of this infrastructure is just getting more and more. And so It's On wants to help bridge that gap. Save you money, so you're only paying for the data you use in most cases, while actually giving the carriers a chance to make more money somehow. The math apparently works by customizing and tailoring what they can charge and being able to charge things. Now, here's where it starts to bother me. They gave examples of buy a day of streaming video or a week's worth of Facebook as a reward to your son or daughter for doing their chores. Amazon could pay for data for shopping their store. A snack company could pay for data to stream a sporting event. You could split your work and your personal data use so that your workplace pays for your work data and you pay for your personal data. It's aimed at people who don't purchase data plans at all or are hesitant to add second data plans like for tablets. But it raises some serious questions about net neutrality, which, by the way, the FCC guidelines don't apply to wireless. So they get to do this under the current guidelines. But is what sounds like a great thing, which is like, hey, let's make it so you only pay for the data you use, actually what we need? You know, if you're going to have to pay per app for your data connection.
Tom, I am so with you. I'm so glad you said that, because I've read a couple of stories on this thing, and they're all talking about how it's innovative and it's pay as you go. You can split things out. And then they talk about here in the All Things D story, you know, saying a company like eBay or Amazon might pay for high-speed access for those browsing virtual shopping sites. I am so with you on this. There are unintended consequences and probably not very good ones of paying for different types of bits. We have been through this before. It is not good for the development of new businesses online. I really believe that. I'm glad you mentioned that.
And The whole premise, because Mark Andreessen's a smart guy, he understands the needs of users. He's a very customer-centric guy. The whole thing is premised on the idea that carriers need to not be dumb pipes, or they won't be able to afford to roll out the infrastructure. Now, I've done a special on bandwidth caps, and granted, we were talking about wireline. There's different issues in wireless. But overall, the idea is that the more data you use doesn't drive up the cost. So paying for data use is just a way to capitalize on the infrastructure. It isn't actually a direct connection where the more data you use, the more infrastructure I have to roll out. There's an indirect connection there, obviously. If you have a lot more customers, you need a lot more infrastructure. But if the the blinking lights don't cost more just to send the data through.
Let's try this little thought experiment. Do you think if there was It's On service available right now for people and you could buy it, that the average person would see their cellular or their data plan costs per month go down? Do you think that would happen?
Possibly. They're so expensive right now. I think that's what Andreessen Horowitz is banking on. Is there most people it would go down.
In order for this to seem compelling to anybody. What about just the convenience factor? This all sounds very complicated to me. I don't want to think about rewarding you for cleaning up the Twit bathroom with a week on Facebook.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't want to do that. I want to feel like I pay for my monthly plan and I access Facebook whenever I want. And I just think it sounds complicated.
Is this about prioritizing bits, or they're just coming up with fancy names for plans?
Well, it's on a software that will run on your device, and it works with the carriers to monitor your connection mm-hmm. and say, okay, we're going to make it so a Facebook app can be pay per use. So that the data through a particular app can be like, okay, I'm just going to pay for that data, and the flip side of that is you can lock out that data. Maybe I'm misunderstanding it. I haven't dived into all the way It's On works. It just sort of came out of hiding. So there may be answers to this stuff, but it sounds to me like they're segmenting up your data connection even more than it already is. Right now, it's bad enough that I have to think, as Sarah says, about how many bits I'm using. Microsoft unveiled the DataSense thing, which is a great way of keeping track of that. I wish it was a problem we didn't have to solve. This makes it so that you're actually not just keeping track, but paying per application. It changes the way the internet works on your phone.
It definitely sounds like the wireless carriers could charge a lot more by simply saying you're going to get a month of Facebook, you know, for unlimited access during that month, because that only, you know, that's only a couple of bits per month anyway. But unlimited streaming for video, that's probably more like a 5 or 6, maybe 5 to 10 gigabyte plan. They'll charge you a ton of money. It's kind of like there could be an easy markup on those bits for Facebook, because you're like, oh, it's a month of Facebook. I'm getting a month of service. I'll pay $30 for that, or whatever they would charge. Kind of like when you go to a bar and a beer costs $6. You're like, oh, that's fine when you're at a bar. A supermarket, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So it's that weird, like, I think it allows the carriers to do this. They can charge more per bit, even though you're not noticing it, because you think you're getting more because you're just getting Facebook and not necessarily streaming.
Hang on. So let's work this out here. This is new to me, so forgive me. This might sound just a little off the cuff, but suppose for the sake of argument, we have the service and Facebook wants people to use and Facebook has will subsidize your use of Facebook using It's On. Now, Facebook also, when you go to a web link inside a Facebook post, especially on mobile, they fire up the browser inside of Facebook, where they have full control over your browsing experience. So this type of service, Facebook, in association with a company like It's On, could basically financially begin to take people off of the open internet and onto these walled garden web browsers.
Even more than they already do, yeah.
Yes. So I think there are some consequences here that really have to be looked at before we bless this thing. I mean, if prices go down, great. If we have shared data plans across all our, you know, 6 mobile devices in a family, great. But what we're talking about here is a form of a la carte purchasing that could have some consequences, especially when the big guys, eBay, Facebook, Apple, whomever, get involved and say, oh, wow. We can take all of a user's behavior and encapsulate it and give them a little in return. In the return, we get advertising revenue and unbelievably more data than we're getting right now on what users are doing.
Yeah, because it could make it so that a Fab.com or a Gilt or even an Etsy can't get started because everybody uses Amazon and eBay because those are the ones that are free to use. They don't count against my data cap. So of course I'm going to shop with them. Saves me money. Let's talk about Microsoft opening that Windows Store for developers, because Build Conference starts today.
Yeah, it started. It's a 4-day conference happening on Microsoft's Redmond campus. Obviously, the goal is to sell Windows 8 to developers, or sell the idea of developing on Windows 8 to developers. Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer said analyst expectations at the Windows 8 launch was that 400 million new PCs will be sold next year, most of which will run on Windows 8. So this is all supposed to be very exciting for developers. We mentioned Google's new Nexus 10 earlier in the show. Not only does that look like a very nice tablet, but Google says it has about 700,000 apps in Google Play. Now, if you compare that to what Apple said last week in their iPad mini announcement, Apple said it had over 700,000 apps. Well, that's probably not 800,000, or they would have said that. So we're looking at pretty much neck and neck in these two app stores. Now, of course, iOS has long touted the fact that they just have more volume. I mean, I've said that for a long time, that's really what's compelling about iOS is that you have so many more apps. And that's just simply not really true when you're comparing Apple to Google anymore. Of course, the quality of apps is a whole nother story, but the volume is absolutely there. When it comes to Microsoft, it's absolutely not there. Not yet, anyway. Windows Store was announced, what, about a year ago to developers? And they're at about 5,000 apps, at least in the U.S. There are more apps that are available in other countries. But we're not even talking a 100,000. We're talking a very, very small portion of that.
I thought they announced a bigger number yesterday during the Windows Phone.
That was Windows Phone 8, announcement. I thought.
Okay, so we're talking about Windows 8 versus Windows Phone. Got it.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that Microsoft is doing differently. You know, when iOS started, it was just the iPhone, right? There are a bunch of apps that get developed for the iPhone, and then Apple says, okay, well, now we're going to make a really big iPhone called an iPad, take away the phone part. But the apps, for the most part, will run on the bigger version. Microsoft isn't really doing that. I mean, Windows 8 on tablets is a different beast than Windows Phone 8.
Well, and there's also RT versus 8.
And there's that too.
Right. A Windows 8 app on your desktop will run on the Windows 8 Surface when it comes out. But it won't run on the Windows RT tablet. And the Windows RT apps won't run on anything but RT. And won't run on Windows Phone 8 or Windows 8.
And the only place you can get RT apps is through the Windows Store.
Yeah.
Whereas in standard Windows, I'll call it standard Windows 8, you can do the standard thing, buy an app, download it, install it, right?
I believe that the SDK was released relatively short, it was a short time ago. You can compile for both 8 and RT if you want to. That's the Microsoft's trying to encourage that. At the Build conference, they actually gave out Surface RTs to everybody there. Mm-hmm. So they're obviously trying to get the developers on their side.
You know what? The chat room is calling me on it. You're right. The RT apps can run on Windows 8. Because they only run in the tile interface, so they are cross platform.
Right. So the RT apps should run on 8 as long as it's from the Windows Store. Windows Store apps run on Windows RT and Windows,
but not 8. On Windows Phone.
Not on Windows Phone yet. But the thing of the whole grasping at this whole thing is that the kernel is the same. So theoretically, it's supposed to be a lot easier to take applications from Windows 8 to Windows Phone and back and forth. Then, theoretically, you get these developers on board.
Theoretically. Okay, that's the conversation that we're having, right, is when a developer who's got, a minimal amount of time and energy to develop and trying to figure out where is my time best spent, because as a developer, I'd like to make money off of these apps that I'm creating. Does this all sound like a big headache? I mean, I think Microsoft is doing everything that they can to make this all seem very compelling. The Build conference looks like it's going to be very informative. They're getting free stuff. It's pretty cool. A lot of people are going. 4-day conference. I mean, they're probably going to feed them nice stuff. But is this still enough to keep developers excited?
Well, that's why that RT distinction is important, and I'm glad folks called me on it, because the idea is that when Microsoft is trying to make it so that you write once, run everywhere, right? So if you write a tile app for Windows RT, it will run on Windows 8, but it will only run in the tile interface. Most people are using Windows 8 still in the desktop, and it won't run on the desktop. It'll only run in full screen on the tile interface. So I'm not sure how useful that is.
We're in the middle of a big transition here. I mean, look, I'm speaking now from within a software company, Evernote, drink. and the Windows tile interface is a different platform. It might run on the same core, but we developed, the standard desktop version and the tile version because it might be the same hardware, but it's a different platform, and users expect different things and want to do different things. So you really do need to develop them separately for the two UIs. You have to figure out which product you want users to use, where you think you're going to sell the most or get the most users, and write for that platform in specific. I mean, you can't say, well, we'll just kind of do it half and half. It doesn't work that way. You have to figure out what platform you're doing it for.
Well, Steve Ballmer said that they've moved 4 million upgrades already of Windows 8. So that's pretty impressive considering it's been out for a couple of days. So if they can get that many people, they want to say 400 million at some point. I think it's going to be pretty easy to get developers for whatever this new interface is, because Microsoft's putting up $1.5 billion into advertising with this. I mean, if WebOS could get developers, and they did, and there's developers for Enyo, I'm pretty sure that people will think, oh yeah, the dominant player in the desktop market, we're going to still go over there, because this is, right now it's a gold rush because there's only 5,500 apps out there. The first app that's really good at something might become like the spotlight app in Windows 8. So this is, I think they're going to get developers no matter what.
They're Microsoft. They're going to get developers, but it is going to be still confusing for people. Just like it's confusing for some people that your OS 10 apps don't run on iOS.
There's no reason to have an operating system that is the same on the desktop as it is on the smartphone. They are fundamentally different devices.
I want to have the appearance of it as a consumer sometimes, though, right? I want to not have to think about it.
Blue stacks
you
for
can
all.
Code different ones. I don't care. But if I bought Netflix and I'm living in the Windows world, why do I have to download it in again and have it different on Windows Phone?
Maybe that's what Forstall said, too.
And now look what happened
And look what happened to him, Rafe.
Yeah, he's going to retire with hundreds of millions of dollars from Apple, the poor guy.
Yeah, poor man. We're starting to run a little long, so let's quickly finish up with Google launching a voter tool ahead of the presidential election, part of our tech election coverage. Which, by the way, a week from today is voting day, and Sarah Lane and I are going to anchor a hangout. I hesitate to call it coverage. We're going to hang out here.
It's coverage.
For people who
are covering the election.
Kind of sick of coverage. We're the anti-coverage.
This coverage will be about like curtains so you can move them and like levers.
Yeah. We're going to talk a lot about our personal political views.
Oh, I love that.
Oh, wow.
Justin Robert Young. That is not the point.
Justin Robert Young will be live from Florida, swing state.
Florida.
Oh, wow. Well, if you want to know some information about what's going on about this election, Google's launched a new tool. It's called the Voter Information Tool. It tells you where your polling place is. It gives you a ballot summary with links to the candidates' main web pages, other outlets like Twitter and Facebook. In addition, it's linked to the 2012 election YouTube channel. So if the candidate you're interested in has a lot of coverage, you can find that on YouTube right there. Obviously, the tool shows you who's running for president. I had no idea that Roseanne Barr is running for president with the Peace and Freedom Party. So if you want to find out more about that platform, you can easily do that as well.
Don't follow me on Instagram, do you?
The voter information tool is embeddable and open source. So if you want, you can put it on your website and you can customize it. Don't forget to vote next week, November 6th.
We'll put that up. Vote now. Vote early. Vote often. That's the point. Now, but maybe we'll use this in our hangout on next Tuesday night.
Fancy.
Let's move on to the randomizer. This ad is getting a lot of buzz, but it's not really an ad. It's a parody. It's about the iPad Mini, and it's essentially trashing the iPad Mini. It's got Johnny Five, not the movie Johnny Five robot. It's making fun of Johnny Ive, but the iPod Touch.
And that's exactly what the iPad Mini is. Wait, the iPad Mini is not the iPod Touch. I don't want that to sound confusing, even though they have the same processor. They are different. The iPod Touch has a Retina display.
iPad Mini is the thinnest iPad we've ever designed. Surprise, surprise. It's 0.4 millimeters thinner than the iPhone 5, which was just released a month ago. So as usual, each product is thinner than the last. It's always going to be thinner. Except with the third generation iPad, which is now the old, new iPad. And not the Retina display iPad. Not to be confused with the iPad Mini, which does not have a Retina display, but is thinner.
In iPad Mini...
So it goes on with those kinds of jokes, and it finishes up with the thing that's being most quoted is Johnny Five saying, you know, this is the future of iPad, at least until the end of May, at the latest. Kind of, you know, implying that the release cycle is going to continue.
These kinds of parodies have been everywhere, even like on Conan O'Brien. They're the same. Like, it's like I get the joke at this point. It's like, All right, yes, I know. They upgrade things. Great. Tired of them.
Ayaz hates fun. Rafe, what did you think of it?
I actually think that Apple was late to come out with a mini-size iPad, but that's maybe a different topic for this. I thought the ad, yeah, I'm with Ayaz. It was kind of like, okay, I get it. But, you know, the way that you build an impenetrable wall of products is to have things at all sizes and price points. Apple proved this with the iPod line, and it was just a matter of time before the iPad. The iLine had a big gaping hole where the minis came in, and they had to fill it, and I'm glad they did. I think it's smart. I think these ads or parodies are just kind of silly. People will buy what they want.
Apple fanboy doesn't like being made fun of. What about you, Sarah?
Do I like being made fun of? Not very much. No.
No. What did you think?
I don't know. Yeah. These are good for a little chuckle, I guess. I mean, this is the makers of this video make a good point. I mean, they're not saying anything that we haven't already heard from people saying. Wait, so the new iPad is the old new iPad? That's actually something that I'm seeing written in articles. Not even really tongue in cheek. That is what it is. It's the old new iPad.
I thought it was entertaining. I thought there were some funny lines in it. Sure. I don't understand why this one's getting so much more buzz than the other ones. Geekbeat did one where they were, you know, making fun before the iPad mini announcement. And like I said, there's been a bunch of these. Conan did.
This is Give Me Attention While I Talk About a Topic That's Relevant to You. Mm. It's an age-old thing.
It's a good thing we have cameras on us when
that happens on the internet. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well,
speaking of attention,
if you want to buy any of those products that we were just mocking in that video, you might want to get some cash. And this episode brought to you by Gazelle. If you want new gadgets, you need to get money out of your old gadgets. And Gazelle is the simplest way to do it. What you do is you lock in the quote, but you keep your gadget for 30 days because your quote's good for 30 days. So do it now. It's risk-free. Gadget's probably not going to get more valuable over 30 days. So lock in that quote now. It's easy. They put pictures of the gadgets up. How much easier could they make it for you? There's no reason not to go. Gazelle.com. Put up your old gadgets, even if you're not sure you want to sell them. Lock in the quote. Then, once you find out how much you're going to get, you can go shopping for your new gadget. You can even go buy the new gadget. Put it on your credit card or something. Send the old gadget back with the free shipping label Gazelle provides. Get your cash by check or PayPal in a couple of days. Then use that money to pay off your bill. It's the simplest and easiest way I have ever found to sell your old gadget. So go to gazelle.com and try it out today. Find out what your old iPhone is worth, your old iPad. Take a minute and lock in that price at gazelle.com. And we thank Gazelle for their support of Tech News Today. So there's a calendar, is there?
There is.
What's on it?
Wow, okay. It's like you read my mind. The Nokia Lumia 920 is shipping first to Rogers in Canada, which makes Rogers the first for $100. And GameStop is going to sell the WikiPad gaming tablet for $499 starting tomorrow, Halloween, or October 31st in countries that don't like fun.
Wait, go back. Canada first?
Canada is now Canduda.
Like all Canduda. I used to suffer from Canduda.
So glad you don't anymore. Congratulations.
Thank you. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
I got emails, Iaz.
We got one from David, the programmer in Florida. In a recent tweet, you were talking about how before MS-DOS, it was usual for the hardware makers to make the OS for the hardware. That was true for a lot of manufacturers, but before there was MS-DOS, there was CPM from Digital Research, which was the standard for business machines that used the 8080, 8085, and the Z80. I'm not pointing this out to be a nitpicker.
Oh, aren't you?
But to give one of the pioneers of the micro revolution his due, far few people remember Gary Kildall.
Okay.
MS-DOS was, in many people's opinion, a copy of CPM for the X86.
I can get behind giving Gary Kildall some props. Well done, David the programmer. Thank you for that email. And that's it for this show. Thank you, folks, for submitting stories at our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com. We look at it every day to figure out what stories we might want to cover in the day. And this is our hint from you. We look at all kinds of sources. This is your way to say, hey, I want you to cover that Apple executive responsible for Maps is going to leave. I want you to cover Google's quiet Nexus launch proves we don't actually need the fanfare. So go to technewstoday.reddit.com, submit some stories, or just vote on the stories that have been submitted, or do both. And we thank you for your support there. Rafe Needleman, great to have you on the show. It's like old times. Always love hearing your insight, man. Plug away. What do you got to tell the folks?
So one of the things I'm doing here at Evernote is writing a column about startups and the opportunities that these startups represent for the rest of us in tech. It's at the column is called Opportunity Notes, and you can find it at opnotes, OPPNOTES.com.
Are you down with OPPNotes.com?
Am I what?
Ah, finally. Someone
who doesn't know that joke. I love it.
I'll explain it later. Go check it out.
Go there. Read it.
Opnotes.com. Thanks, everybody, for watching or listening. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, TNT@twit.tv, or give us a call and leave us voicemail 260-TNT-SHOW. Steve Kovach joins us tomorrow. We'll see you then.